My name is Dick Anderson. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be here. My home group now is in Louisville, Kentucky. We live near it, called the Early Bird Group. It's the only group I ever started in AA. I started in 1978. And I got sober in Louisville. My first 4 years were spent up there. And then I was spent 38 years here. And so I spent a lot more time in sobriety and in service and growing up in Georgia than I did up there. But we've moved back a couple of years ago. We moved back just in time for the pandemic, so we really haven't gone to that many meetings. We've been on Zoom a lot, but both of us have some high risk, so we haven't been out too much. But what I wanted to talk about was Barbara and I, we've done all kinds of workshops. We've done workshops on living in the traditions and all of those kind of things. But instead of that, just this is going to be more of what was called in high school. I was on the speech and debate team, but there was a category called extemporaneous speaking, which just means you make up stuff. So anyway, but that's going to be kind of what we're talking about is experience. There has been terrific enthusiasm this whole weekend. And enthusiasm is derived from the Greek entheos, which means God in us. And we recognize the God in the other person, and that's why we're so enthusiastic. We connect. We see. But that can be an instant thing. There were people here with, you know, just a few days who were gratified by the enthusiasm we had, you know, for the speakers the last few days. But in AA and in life, if we're lucky, we gain something that's acquired over time by experience, and it's not something that's academic. And it's called wisdom. And the old-timers, not all, but the old-timers who've worked hard in here, shared that wisdom with me when I first got here. And it wasn't something that they said. The big book is full of wisdom. They're the words. But there is a big difference in living this experience and talking about it. And things have changed a great deal since I came in. My sobriety date is June the 8th, 1977, so I have 45 years in a couple of months. And during, at the time that I came in, the old-timers were people who got sober in the 40s and the 50s. People who had 25 and 30 years had gotten sober in the 40s and the 50s then. And they got sober before the 12 and 12 was ever written. And I went to 9 speaker meetings a week. And afterwards, we lived together. We went to places to get ice cream or to eat or whatever. But the way we got sober in the beginning when I got here was through 12-step calls. We would drive 4 or 5 hours. We would do whatever was necessary. We'd go to any hospital. We would go someplace to find a wet drunk. Because if we could find a wet drunk, it would help us stay sober. And that's what's written about in the big book. But we have gotten a little bit off track, I think, my opinion, in that we've got all these workshops going on now and people who are revered because they teach the workshops. But the only teacher in Alcoholics Anonymous is experience. And experience comes by doing. And if you have been, how many people in here have been on a 12-step call with a wet drunk? Good. That's better than average. There are a lot of people that haven't. There weren't lots of treatment centers. There was no treatment center where I came in at the time. And we would go to the hospital, and we would see a policeman that was had been in put in the hospital 15 times because if anybody found out he had actually had a problem, he'd get fired. But we would go there, and then I would see that person later, and I would see them come to... And here's my part in going on these 12-step calls. I went and didn't say anything. In the beginning, I just said, you know, go along with us, watch what we do. And after a while, we'll let you know when you can participate. But we want you to see what we're doing in AA now. So Jack Sullivan, who was my sponsor, and Sonny Whittle, and other people like that, they're all passed on now. But these are people that lived, and on any given day, they would be out calling on somebody and bringing them in. And then Barbara talked earlier during the call where I was bringing people home for me when I was on the 12-step call list in Atlanta. And when we first got married, and they did not take me off the 12-step call list. That was I didn't get off the list. I just stopped bringing people home because there's a risk when you're bringing in street drunks and they're staying there. And now I've got a wife, so I just stopped bringing them home and took them to other places. But for a long time, I would go pick somebody up downtown because I lived very close to downtown. I would take them back to the house, and that would be, and that experience of being with them and sitting up all night with them, and they get sick, and we call a doctor if they went into DTs, and that experience, and then watching that person grow and seeing how they were after a month and 2 months and 3 months, and a lot of them didn't, you know, as soon as they got to feeling better, they'd go back out there. But the ones who stuck, that was the most dramatic and powerful thing that could happen to me, because I had been out on the street and I had brain damage, and it took about a year or so for me to learn how to read again when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And that experience, watching that and being with these guys and getting in the car with them and going to these things, was great. Now, we went to meetings all the time. After the meetings, we all went out afterwards. The other thing that we experienced a great deal in those days, and there's no reason that you cannot do this now, except that society has changed enough that we've gotten away from it. But family recovery was a big part of it. Every AA meeting we had an Al-Anon meeting on the other side of the church. And every third night there was an Al-Ateen meeting. And out of 60 couples in my home group, only two ended up in divorce. 58 of them, AA, Al-Anon, remained and had good marriages. They had a lot of repair that had to be done. But like I said, there were only two out of the 60 that didn't make it. And when I came in, I wasn't connected with anybody. I'd never been married. I'd been engaged 6 times, but nobody would actually marry me. because they had wisdom. And so, but that experience to me, being part of a family, is what we have here. There are people here like Harry and Sissy and other people that I've known for a long time that have been involved where we were involved in service trying to figure out how we could help more people who feel like family. And I know if they came anywhere near us, they could stay with us for as long as they want, the same thing. And it's just, there is a sense of family. We stayed with Chip and Angie when we were down in Florida, and we are family to each other. And these are things that are not necessarily written in a, you know, there are 4 chapters before you get to the 5th chapter. The 5th chapter where we start working the steps is great. But the first 4 chapters all deal with surrender and with humility. And I'm going to close talking about humility, anonymity, some of the things that we deal with now and how things have changed. But what I wanted to talk about first was this. When we come in here, you know, we talk about, it's in that, like I said, it's not an academic program, and even our book says that. It says, this is in More About Alcoholism, it says, the actual or potential alcoholic, with hardly an exception, will be absolutely unable to stop drinking on the basis of self-knowledge. You can quote the big book verbatim and still not get sober. And you can go without drinking and still not have a worthwhile life. I mean, just not drinking is not the whole thing. It's to have a full, rich life where we have our purpose. And our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be a maximum service to God and those about us. And I made a lot of mistakes in that area, too. When I came in, one of the things that I did after I got sober was I was everything AA. I was AA this, AA that. I mean, I spent all my time with AA and with AA friends and with AA people. And in the beginning, I think that's necessary. But I did it for a long time. And I had some very, very good friends from school and from the service and from other places that I neglected, that I didn't go back and connect with because I was so involved with AA. And there's kind of a high you can get being involved in AA and going to these conferences and doing all the things that you do. And I got connected to that. But there were very good friends who had actually saved my life at times when I was drinking because they didn't have a problem and they took care of me. And when we moved back to Louisville, I went to see some of these people, and several of them are at Cave Hill Cemetery, where my parents are buried. They're just not there anymore. And what we do and our image and our reputation to people outside of the program, I think, is just as important as to the people inside the program, because those are people who may know somebody that needs some help. They may be somebody that they themselves need some help. And it's not just in the area of alcoholism. I recovered from a kind of cancer, esophageal cancer, that's 90% fatal. And so there are people that I've been able to help in that. I had a couple of combat tours, and there are veterans that I've been able to deal with to help with that. We all have different areas where we have strengths and skills. When I do, we do this inventory in the beginning, that just as the step says. But with anybody that I've got that's got any time in, we do an annual state of the life. Once a year, we sit down and we go through with these guys. I go through and we go through everything they're doing and seeing if they're spending more than they've got. Are they spending more time than they've got? Are they spending more money than they've got? Are they spending more love than they've got? Whatever it is, we've only got a certain amount of time each month. We've only got a certain amount of love that we can give. We've only got a certain amount of, you know, what your budget is for money, and that's much easier to acquire. But it's not easier to find out. You know, I know some people, and I did this. You can't promise 50 things to 50 different people and not have the time or the money to do it and fail at all of those and be successful. And I'm not talking about business. I'm talking about in life. Every sponsor I had one thing that was most important to them. Keep your word, and if you say you're going to do something, do it. And show up and do it. And that's very difficult for somebody like me to do. I get paid to dream. I'm a writer. I get paid to think. I daydreamed when I was in school. And so, you know, people paid me a lot of money when I was in New York, you know, writing and producing, because I was daydreaming. And so for me to show up, if you say you're going to be someplace at some time, no matter what it is, to show up and do that. These are things I learned that aren't in the big books. They don't say you must show up for every appointment. But it implies that. It tells us what to do. And my purpose has expanded to the extent that I've had these experiences. Because I had cancer and recovered, I have another purpose. Because I survived a couple of combat tours, I have another purpose. Because I have, when I got involved in service work and Alcoholics Anonymous, it was because I was told to, and I did what they told me to do, and I learned. And what I learned from that was we've got, you know, the 12 steps, we've got the 12 traditions, and we've got the 12 concepts. Well, the 12 steps are about how I learned to live with myself. The 12 traditions are how to live with other people. And we learn that in service work. And we get together a bunch of alcoholics where we're all, you know, me. And we get together and find out how to open up and let other people have a voice. And I can tell you, you know, one of the things you learn if you're, you know, lucky enough to be delegate is you are not in charge of anything. The people who are in charge are the people you serve. The word servant and service took on a whole new meaning. We're there to serve, to be of use, to help somebody. And we can help sometimes in guiding, but it's not our job to guide. Our job was to sit and listen to the fellowship and listen to the assembly. When you go to the assembly and you listen to people and listen to what is on their mind, your job is to take that up to the General Service Conference and share that, because that may be the same thing that's on the mind of a lot of people, and there may be something that can be done at the General Service area. And the only thing we do in service is improve our ability to carry the message to others and stay unified in that attempt. That's all service is for. There's no big shot. There's no nothing. And the only thing we produce up there in New York is literature and events that carry out those two things. That's it. There's nothing sophisticated or anything or beyond that. That's it. But if you get involved in service, and service means somebody that worked on one of the committees for this, whoever did this beautiful artwork, whoever's, you know, Nancy's keeping this board over here. I just found out that I spoke here in 2004. I spoke in 2013, but I spoke in 2004, too. And I didn't speak with the people that I thought I spoke with. So, you know, you don't always remember, but the people that do all this, the people that, all the guys that were carrying the 3,000 cases of peanut butter last night, you know, and those guys are learning that they, by doing some kind of service, they're part of. They learn more from carrying that peanut butter, in my opinion, than just going to one Big Book Workshop. The Big Book's a great book, but we've got all this emphasis right now on academic, and this is not an academic program. This is an get up, get dressed, go do it, that kind of program. And people take people with them on the same journey that they've had. And when I got here, I had guys that took me every place. They made me part of. I didn't have any money, so they took me with me and put me in let them stay in one of their rooms when we go to a conference. They'd help me get, my first year I was a little brain damage and so they would take me with them and they would pick up whatever expenses was. And then when I would try to pay them back after I got better, they said, just pass it on. So you do the same thing for somebody else. And that was the way it always was. Pass it on. Nobody wanted to be repaid. They wanted me to do it for the people coming after me. And I was able to do that. And, you know, our life has been a series of ups and downs. I'm a writer, which is kind of like being an actor, which means you don't have a job. And unless you're working on something right now, you ain't working. And so Barbara has, you know, she shared with you today. So we've had a life where we have found something in it called joy. And joy is something I never had before, and it's mentioned in the Big Book. But the joy is the result of humility. And I'm going to talk about that after Barbara gets through. But humility is the key. The first four chapters are all about surrendering. And as I mentioned, the biggest thing that I knew, and I knew it from the very beginning, I didn't have the language, I wasn't articulate, but it was lack of power. And it says, that's exactly what this book is about, lack of power, that was our dilemma, it says. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourselves which will solve your problem. That means we have written a book which we believe to be spiritual as well as moral, and it means, of course, that we're going to talk about God. Well, in the book, and intellectually, I can talk about that, but that's not how I found God. That is not how I found God. I found God in the behavior of the people I followed. In the end of action, it says, the spiritual life is not a theory, we have to live it, but the three sentences down, it says, our behavior will convince them more than our words. And behavior is something we do 24 hours a day. Having a Big Book workshops on a weekend, reading the Big Book, you can do it all you want to, but I can tell you that when I came in, we read the book at one meeting a week, and then your sponsor would work with you on it, but the sponsor would work with you more on doing the things that help somebody else get sober and doing the things like paying your bills, doing the things that you learn how to do as an adult where you become responsible, and which is a term that I didn't care for, which is why I was only engaged 6 times and not married once. I was not responsible, and people knew that about me. And I was good at what I did, and I would make good money at sometimes, but I was not responsible. And I had to learn how to do that in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did that by watching the people ahead of me, and watching the people that I lived with, and watching the people that I went to meetings with. So that's, you know, that's basically what we wanted to start on. Barbara's going to share her experience that she's had in Al-Anon, which is, I'm not an Al-Anon member, but I've been to hundreds and hundreds of Al-Anon meetings because, and as I said, because we had family recovery, we were around Al-Anon a lot. And I can tell you that I've run into some people that tried to help the Louisville guys, and I said, is your wife in Al-Anon? They said, oh, no, my sponsor's wife is not in it, and they're fine. So there's a whole bunch of people now that think that Al-Anon has no real benefit to AA. But I can tell you that family recovery is not done with one program. It's done with both programs. And telling you some of the experience in her program is Barbara, my wife.
Hi, everybody. I'm Barbara Anderson, Grateful Al-Anon. I have several categories of topics I'm going to share with you. One of them, and I've already talked just briefly about it during my talk, and that is, this really is a spiritual program, and over the last few years, it seems like there's, in many areas, there seems to be more and more effort to separate the spirituality part of AA and Al-Anon away from the program. And it's very dangerous to do that. You know, I heard Lois's words, gratefully, back in 1985. And I think a lot of us, as I did, have some kind of spiritual wound we come into the program with. And instead of working on that, you know, decide that my higher power is going to be a tree or my sponsor. And maybe that works for a while. What I usually do when I'm working with a new Al-Anon is say, why don't you borrow mine for a while? You know, and just because they hear about all the experiences I have and they believe they must have happened. So that often works for me. Sometimes it's fear of offending. We don't want to offend anyone. So, you know, we take the word God out of books. Al-Anon's really bad about doing that. They've actually, literally, when I was a delegate, we were writing a new book, and the author had, there was, the word God was not in the whole book. And we ended up having a whole literature committee inventory. They ended up with going through two or three more authors. And Pastor Recovery is the result. You know, conference approved literature actually works, but it's, who is working for us makes a difference too. And I'm grateful for that spiritual program because it really has been a transforming way of me living. I don't know, I'm speaking for Al-Anon today, but what I've discovered over the years is that Al-Anons either come into the program, they really think that they're going to find the magical answer, excuse me, how to keep somebody sober that we have stored in the back shelf behind the books in the cabinet in the room where we meet. And if they stay around long enough, we'll give them the clue. And when they finally realize that they really need to work the steps themselves, we sometimes lose people at that point. We often lose people at the point of them needing to look at the fourth and fifth step. But over the years, I've been amazed, personally, this is my personal experience, of how many people I did a fourth and fifth step with, and then they left. And it's interesting because I've shared this several times recently when I've spoken, and I've had a lot of sponsors come up and tell me and they'd had the same experience and they didn't know anybody else had had it. It was like one of those experience things that we just hadn't recognized that other people struggled with. But, you know, an Al-Anon does the fifth step and suddenly recognizes, oh my God, I have to change. And they don't want to. So they go on and divorce the alcoholic then, and they might show up a few more years later with another one. But or they might not ever make it back, you know. I had one that decided not to do, you know, 6 through 9, and she's now qualifying for the other program. Anyway, it's today when I'm working with a new sponsee and we're looking at doing the house cleaning process, I let them know up front, we're going to do 4 and 5, and there's going to be times in this process you're going to want to leave. And I'm asking you now, you know, to talk to me as we go through this process if you start feeling that. And so I just start talking to them about it from the get-go, that they may have these feelings of wanting to run. And I haven't had one leave since I started talking about it. You know, it wasn't really a big thing. It was just recognizing how often it had happened and began to talk to it. And I also, when I'm listening to somebody's fifth step, I jot down some character defects. And I say, well, let's start with these things you mentioned today. And let's pray and ask God to help you remove those. And we're going to do some more work around 6 and 7. But at least you started the process. And that helps too. Dick alluded to this. You know, when I first came into Al-Anon, we really were so much more of a family program. You know, everybody seemed like we were together. There was couples everywhere. We went in and did things together. You know, sometimes Dick and I struggled to find other couples. you know, in the program will go to a conference and there's just not many. There's, you know, AAs and maybe there's a few Al-Anons, but they don't seem to connect. And I have been observing for a while now, and of several things I want to tell you. One thing, and maybe I'm not completely well, but this is my story. I was at a conference, speaking at a conference, and Dick wasn't there, and so I was in the AA hospitality room. And I was sitting down, and there was a guy behind me. And he, and his sponsor, I could tell it was a sponsor and a sponsee. And the sponsee asked the sponsor, "Well, now, should I take my wife to the Al-Anon meeting? And he said, "Oh, hell no, you don't want to do that. I mean, she will make your life a living hell if she goes to Al-Anon. Don't you do that." And he went on and on and on. And his sponsee said, "Well, okay," and he left. So I got up and sat down next to the sponsor. And I said, "Just out of curiosity, you know, why did you tell him that?" And he looked at my ribbon. He realized who all of it. He said, he was real red, but he said, "Well, my wife went to Al-Anon. She made my life a living hell." I said, "Well, how long does she go to Al-Anon? She's still going?" She said, "Well, she went to 5 or 6 meetings." And I said, "If somebody went to 5 or 6 AA meetings, would you call them a member of AA? You think they'd be sober today?" And he said, "Well, no." And I said, "Well, why do you think that she represented Al-Anon?" And he said, "Oh, my God." So he went and he found his sponsee and his sponsee's wife and 3 other sponsees that were there and their wives, and they all sat on the front row, okay? And I ran into them again about 3 years later at another conference, and they sat on the front row again. And they all were telling me stories about how their lives and relationships had been transformed because they were working a program together. You know, there's a language we learn here. There's a program language we learn. And I can't imagine, I completely understand why Dick said when we were dating that he wouldn't want to marry anybody unless they were an Al-Anon. You know, I completely understand. I didn't understand it back then. But we have this language we learn here. And it's a language of love, but it's a language of the steps and the slogans. And I can't imagine being in a relationship with somebody that didn't understand that. You know, it's like, it would be like having half of a life with them. I can't imagine really being in a relationship and not wanting that other person to be able to share that with me. So it's sometimes tricky if you're in a relationship, because I've often had somebody who's had a spouse who's been not wanting to go to Al-Anon for years and years, or an AA who has not encouraged them to go for years and years and years, and now all of a sudden decides they'd like for them to go. It's not always easy to convince them to go. You know, that's where, you know, you can talk to Dick about Al-Anon, but anyway, it's a challenge. But bringing your family members to something like this, you know, bringing them when you celebrate your anniversaries, or your sponsee's anniversaries, or inviting several of them over for a holiday, or to watch, you know, watch a ball game, or whatever it is, having them become part of your life, at least you're sharing that experience and that language. You know, it's now I have also had to learn some tolerance. You know, I don't often, you know, get in somebody's face like I did that particular day. I talked to my sponsor about it, and she said, "Well, the result was okay," but at the same time, I just love our fellowships together, and I can't imagine, you know, what I don't think Dick and I would be married today if we weren't both working a program and it intersected at times. And I'm just so grateful for that. Grateful for that connection we have together and that that language of the heart that we share. Another thing, kind of going back to the 4th and 5th step, and this is, how many people in here or are in Al-Anon or are a double winner? Okay, well, there's enough of y'all in here to share this. Al-Anon has way too much literature. I don't know if y'all feel that about it. And part of it is Al-Anon is not fully self-supporting through its own voluntary contributions. It is supported by the sale of literature. So they continue to make more and more and more literature, and they make it more and more complicated to know how to tell somebody you sponsor which book to use to go through the steps. If you have a pastor, if you have a Blueprint for Progress, anybody have that book? Okay. I see that book as PhD level Al-Anon. Okay, it is huge. And if you have someone new in Al-Anon in their first year and you're trying to walk them through a fourth and fifth step with this book, a lot of them leave. It's just too much. So starting with something simple, I have had people I've sponsored and they come in with that book and they've, you know, somebody told them they needed to work their fifth step out of that. And they're stuck, and they're thinking about leaving. I said, well, we're going to put this aside for a while. And when we realize what their biggest character defects are, I said, maybe we'll pull that back out and look at some of those questions again. But finding, and I am also not a sponsor that has a black and white, you have to work the steps exactly my way or the highway, because I feel like then I would be sponsoring in my disease and not in my recovery. So I try to meet the people that I was sponsoring from where they are, find out what work they've done, and try to help them find out where to get to go from there. Dick and I have done a lot of work. We've done full, you know, long workshops on using working these traditions together. But one of the ones that's made the most difference for me is talking about purpose. For our group purpose, there's but one ultimate authority. And looking at purpose, looking at what my purpose is, you know, my true purpose is to fit myself to be a maximum service to God and the people about me. And if I'm speaking at a conference that might be offended if I say where that quote came from, I don't, but I'm not afraid to say that that happens to be in the big book. There's become kind of a war almost between people in Al-Anon that have used the big book in their recovery and those that think that it's the ultimate sin to do so. And so I try to ride the fence. It's not always easy, but I try to at least use tolerance and love in working with both groups. But the purpose itself, looking at what my purpose is in life and being sure that what I'm doing with my life matches that. Dick and I spent some time talking about what our purpose was as a couple. And, you know, we talked about our purpose was to be a safe refuge for each other. And to be a place where we could both individually grow and grow together. And then I started to look at my purpose in other relationships. What is my purpose in my job? What is my purpose as in being a sister? You know, my parents have passed, but when they were here, what was my purpose in being a daughter? What did I need to do that job the best I can? And if you haven't taken some time to do that ever, you might want to do that with your sponsor. Honestly look at what is your purpose in each of your relationships. And that's most of what I had to share.
Now, to keep this simple, the power that we seek, you know, we come in, we don't have the power to do most of the things we want to in life. We don't have the power to overcome alcoholism. We don't have the power to rebuild our lives. We're rebuilding our lives and financially, which, you know, is not at all what you'd think or I thought I would have been doing as a 70-something. You know, they have 30-something, so I'm a 70-something. And I didn't think that I would be, you know, in my family, the men live to be 95 or 100, so that means I can't just survive for two more years. I got 20, 25 years. So I know people that have experience. Jip had some experience where they built some wealth for them, but I just spent a year going through everything to get documented for a disability from the VA, something I should have done about 15, 20 years ago, but I didn't do it even though I had the disability because I was making plenty of money, but I wasn't temporarily making plenty of money. And part of that's ego. I'm always going to be able to flip back up and do it. And when I got sick with cancer, there was no flipping back. I mean, I was a feeding tube for 2 years, and those of you who were in service with me, I had a tube underneath my shirt that I was being fed on at night when I was the end of my being delegate and when I was the chairperson for our area. And most people didn't know that. We'd go, the guys, all the area officers, we'd go to this one restaurant and eat on Saturday night, and I'd get some mashed potatoes. That's all I could eat. So my life, and I had been told not to do anything, but you don't get a chance to get elected delegate again, so, you know, or area chair, or whatever it is. So I wasn't giving that up. Ego maybe, but I was able to be useful. But my life changed dramatically, and I didn't accept it very well, always in denial, because I'd always been able to come back and do well. My starter house, I always rented houses because when I was doing well, I'd rent a house and I was renting a nice big old Victorian house when Barbara and I were dating and got married there, and a beautiful house. And if you're renting it, you don't have to do anything. They take care of the house. But then I decided it's time to buy a house. My starter house was $1.25 million. And so I bought that house with like $600,000, $800,000 down. Now, obviously, I was making money then, but that was all my money. I didn't take any money and put. I didn't go to somebody who had more wisdom than me with finances. I decided to do this, and at the time I decided to do it, I'd been in the program a long time. I mean, I'm not amazed when I see people who've been in the program for a long time make mistakes because they don't seek wisdom in a certain area. And to go to an AA meeting and said, is there anybody here that can help me with my finances? Not a good thing, because 80% of the people in the program are more screwed than you are. So, you know, but find somebody who has done something in that area. If you want to find out how to get out of a bad background and become a professor, ask Jane. I mean, she may not know how it happened, but she will tell you what she did. That's how we find out. We find out from other people. It's from our experience. It's seeing what people did. And ego is the biggest enemy to that. By far the biggest enemy. The first four chapters, I said, talk about humility. And humility is that basis where I don't have any of this power. I don't have the intelligence. I don't mean the intelligence aptitude. I mean, I don't have like we mentioned, the military intelligence, actually knowing intelligence to solve certain problems. So I need to find out somebody who does. I need to find somebody who has more experience than me in this area and so forth. And then I need to serve. My job is to serve. And my experience is that my whole purpose on life is to find out what I'm good at. And I do this with the guys I sponsor when we do that annual thing. What are you good at and what are you not good at? Because everybody's good at certain things and not good at other things. And when you find out the things that you're good at, cultivate those so you can use those to help other people and then get somebody else to help you with the areas where you're weak. I mean, this is not complicated, but we don't do it for some reason. I didn't do it. And I have hit and missed. The other thing that doesn't happen in AA is you don't come up on a plateau, and you're there, and you've made it, and everything's okay. I was depressed when I was 15 years sober. I was high as I could be when I was 10, 12 years sober. I was involved in all kinds of service, doing all kinds of things, but there was no joy in my life. Joy is something that I hadn't experienced before. I experienced happy, high, giddy, enthusiastic, all of that. But joy is that feeling underneath, they call it serenity, it's that feeling underneath where I know everything is going to be okay no matter what happens. The worst that can happen to me is I'm going to paradise. And I was holding my best friend's hand, a guy named Keith Lewis. And those of you who know him, know what a wonderful guy he was, but he was just committed, and he had Lou Gehrig's disease, and we didn't know it until a month before he died. We thought he had a stroke because he just wasn't making any sense, And usually with Lou Gehrig's disease, you can't move your hands, your feet, stuff like that. But that wasn't the case with Keith. He was still, you know, able to do that up to the time he died. But I was holding his hand in one hand and holding a crucifix in the other, and his wife was laying next to him at a hospice in Sandy Beach. His sponsor, Sandy Beach and Time Ives, had just been there, and they left, and it left me and his wife and a Eucharistic minister. And suddenly this spirit, and I don't share this a lot, but this spirit came into that room where she and I were just overcome with joy. And his body was failing, and we knew it was failing. And with Lou Gehrig's, you're paralyzed, and you breathe, and then 2 minutes later you have a breath, and then finally we knew it was his last breath. And when it happened, his wife and his best friend high-fived, because we're so full of joy, because he was going home. And he was ready to go home. And Keith was not only my best friend, he was my prayer partner. And he just really loved God. And it didn't matter to him whether you were religious, not religious, any of that stuff. That's not what this is about. If you've ever heard Sandy Beach speak, it doesn't matter to him. He could explain God better than anybody I know. The first person I heard live speaker was Chuck Chamberlain when I was 2 weeks sober. And he was up at the podium, and I can tell you that you can listen to his talk, but you won't get what you got if you were there in a room with him. If you were in the room with him, you knew that God was in the room with you, that there was this spirit that was in the room. Forget the word God. Whatever spirit it is that has the power that we want was in that room. Same thing that's in here. Enthusiasm is a little different because it's exciting, it's here, and all that. But it's not the same as joy. Joy is knowing no matter what's going on. Enthusiasm, you know, can stop. You know, everybody's great, and then you get somebody who, you know, bad speaker, and the enthusiasm goes out the door. Not so with joy. Joy is just absolutely, it's there. It remains there. You know you're going to be okay no matter what. And if there was ever a gift that my friend Case gave to me, being in that room with him to feel that joy when he left, I am not at all afraid to go. Which means that the only thing I've got is how well can I be useful to others between now and then. I'm an excellent writer, much better writer than I am a speaker, and I am working on projects now. One of them is called Changing the World. It's a TV series where each week we show a story, the dramatic story about, true life story about somebody who did some things, sacrificed and did whatever they did that changed the world because of the way they did it for other people. And this is not over dramatic, it's real, true life stories. And those, just telling those stories, what we do all the time in AA, just knowing those stories can help change. So we're doing it in AA, so we just said, let's do it, you know, in real life. And until you get the green light, in my business, until you get the green light and get a paycheck, it's not done, but it looks good. And I'm working on it. And that's what God put me on earth to do, is to be useful, and that's one of the areas in which I can be useful. But what happens is we get a lot of people to come in, instead of looking at and getting an appraisal of what they're really good at and what they're not good at, and using those skills for other people, it's an ego thing. And I think that's where we're getting a little off track now, because we've got a lot of things where you go on Facebook, people break their anonymity, they want everybody to know how long they've been sober, they want everybody to know that they're and so-and-so, shout out for so-and-so, they're going to speak over at this thing, and rah-rah stuff. First of all, anybody who gets up and speaks at a podium in AA is an important, valuable member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to nothing but speaker meetings, and you didn't have to be a great speaker for me to listen to your story and then see how much you've grown over 6 months and 2 years and 3 years. So we're all valuable. Our stories are valuable to everybody else, and so forth. Some of us speak more than others, but that's just, you know, but that doesn't make you a better person. That just means you've got a certain skill and people like what you do. But I went to the bookstore, and I was looking, in the self-help. When I first came in, you would have found the big book, and you would have found, and I have all the books. I did graduate work in intercultural studies. Back in the 60s, we did that because instead of actually behaving and doing what we're supposed to, we could find some enlightenment that would allow us to sleep with different people and do drugs. So anyway, but it doesn't actually say that in the book, but you kind of converted it to that. So, but anyway, but you go through now, and they got to be 100 books in there written by people who got 5 years or less who are telling you their story because it's so powerful, and when they tell their story, it's going to change the world. It's not going to change the world. Changing the world, the stories that we tell about, you know, one of the stories is about a Hebrew woman who donated her kidney to one of the Palestinian kids that was done about a year ago. And her family didn't want it done, and neither did the Palestinian family. But the whole thing climaxed with just some real love between two groups that were fighting each other to the death. And if enough things like that happen, it does change the world. That's what changes the world. Not writing a book about your ego and about being... And these things, you read them and you can tell right off the bat. They want you to know how important they are and how crazy they were and how wild they were, but now how their life has changed. And this is somebody with 5 years or less. And trust me, I know 5 years is a lot if you're in here and you've got, you know, 2 years. But generally if you're somebody with 30 years and somebody's 5 years there, you don't want to leave them unattended on your property. So it's not as much time as you might think it is. So, you know, but that ego is in there. And it's so you've got these books that are going on. The other thing, there was a guy that got me involved in service work, and I'm not going to mention his name, and you won't know him because this was in the 70s and 80s, but he was known nationwide, and he went all over the place, and he was talked about service a lot, and he had had a professional job with a doctor in front of his name, and all of this, and so forth, and I thought, this guy's just great, he's fantastic, and my sponsor didn't sing the same accolades, he knew him, and my sponsor at that time was a guy named Jack Sullivan, who spoke a lot, but he was pretty down to earth. And at any rate, when this guy died, they had to take up a collection to bury him, and he left his wife penniless, even though he had been in a very lucrative profession. He gave that lucrative profession up to go be Mr. AA. So what did his behavior show me? It did not show me humility. It did not show me usefulness. It did not show me power. And we can do that in AA. It's a way for us to get... I know people that have gone to Amway, and they don't sell anything, but they just get high over the experience of being there. And you can almost do that in AA sometimes. You can get sober, but you're not really carrying the message. You're not really paying your bills. You're not, you know, if you're outside of here and you're not paying your bills, and if you're outside of here and you are rude to people, if you're outside of here and you're not nice, you're not affectionate to, you're dating women and you don't treat them well, you don't treat people well, that's not going to attract somebody to Alcoholics Anonymous. What attracts people here is when somebody sees you and they wouldn't know you were in AA, but said, whatever that person is, they keep their word, they pay their bills, they're one of the nicest people I know, they're always down at the hospital taking care of this, they're doing whatever it is. If we live lives like that, we will attract all the people we can. But the second thing is we will have joy because we're not phonies. With me, that's the biggest thing. When I was a kid, somebody reminded me of this. Before I started drinking, I got up, did comedy sketches. And here's the thing. I'm a loner. I'm not really, you wouldn't think it, but I'm not really gregarious. I am around AA because we love, but I'm a loner. I'm a writer. I like to be by myself sometimes. Barbara will say, I'll sit and watch two or three movies. And, you know, so I'm not always, you know, I remember getting used to having pigeons come and knock on my door when I was 2 years sober wasn't my favorite thing because they were interfering with whatever I was doing. You know, then you learn real quick, don't tell your sponsor that. But you know, that was the thing. Now, here's the deal. This guy taught me a valuable lesson of what not to do, but sadly, it wasn't the right way. But people in the program took up and help pay for this woman and pay for her for retirement and everything else. That's just the way we are. We take care of each other. But it would have been a better lesson had I learned that through his behavior. I was looking around when we moved to Louisville. I was looking around for a new group. And There's right near our house, within less than a mile, there was a group. I went to Big Book group. I go in there, a bunch of young people, talking about the Big Book. Nobody had a long-term sobriety. I think most anybody had was like 8 years or something, but they're on it and all stuff, and they've got the Big Book. Knock on the door. One of the church members that was in a church says, "We've got a fellow out here. He's drunk, and he wants some help. Is everybody can help him?" But I was the only one out of 30 people that said, "I'll help," because they were too busy studying the Big Book. You think this is silly, but it's not. I mean, this is a trend right now. As our delegate, well, you're not my delegate anymore because I'm in Kentucky, but would have been my delegate, knows, they're talking about writing a new version of the Big Book because it probably won't be as tough on us and because we won't have to mention with God as much. And there's always going to be a movement towards that because there's always people looking for an easier, softer way. There is no easier, softer way, but the point is, if you actually learn how to love people and deal with people and be honest with people, people like me or don't like me, it doesn't make any difference, but you can love me because I'm here, and if I lay out my heart to you, you will eventually say, "Hey, you're okay." And if you see me working, trying to help somebody else and taking people in like I did to my home when, you know, before I realized, and that was, again, that was a decision. You don't bring somebody that could hurt your wife into your house, so I started taking them other places. I was still on a 12-step list. I'd pick them up, but I'd take them other places. We do the best we can with what we've got. God's will is to do the best you can right now with what you've been given, whatever your skills are. And the trick to humility is finding out what your gifts are. And I'll talk about that tonight because the part of the process for me was finding out what my gifts were. And I didn't find out by me writing down. I found out by getting some feedback from other people as well, too. What am I good at? Well, I got paid a lot of money to write, so I knew I could write. And I had done well in communication, certain things, but other things I didn't do very well at all. Obviously, finances. And but this group, I got up, and then when I came back, I said, "I'm not sure what you guys are studying, but the biggest opportunity you will ever have in your life to get sober and stay sober is working with a new drunk. And I think you guys need to rethink the purpose of this group." And I didn't go back to it. I didn't show them anything. The pandemic started, and I wasn't going to meetings anyway, so it wasn't like I was showing them something. But the point being, I heard they did listen. And then they started doing things where they would actually go help people. So I'm going to read, close with Bill Wilson's. We all know what Dr. Bob said. Keep it simple and keep helping people and blah, blah, blah. And this is Bill Wilson's last statement to the fellowship. So important. He wrote it so people would have a copy of it so they would remember it. "My dear friends, recently an AA member sent me an unusual greeting which I would like to extend to you. He told me it was an ancient Arabian salutation. Perhaps we have no Arabian groups, but it still, although we do now, but it still seems a fitting expression of how I feel for each of you. It says, 'I salute you and thank you for your life. My thoughts are much occupied these days with gratitude to our fellowship and for the myriad blessings bestowed upon us by God's grace. If I were asked which of these blessings I felt was most responsible for our growth as a fellowship and most vital to our continuity, I would say the concept of anonymity. Anonymity has two attributes essential to our individual and collective survival, the spiritual and the practical. On the spiritual level, anonymity demands the greatest discipline of which we are capable. On the practical level, anonymity has brought protection for the newcomer, respect and support of the world outside, and security from those of us who would use AA for sick and selfish purposes. AA must and will continue to change with the passing years. We cannot, or should we, turn back the clock. However, I deeply believe that the principle of anonymity must remain our primary and enduring safeguard. As long as we accept our sobriety and our traditional spirit of anonymity, we will continue to receive God's grace." There is a huge movement that is, I know who founded it. It was a guy that wanted to be better known for himself. His dad was a celebrity, and he wanted to be a celebrity, so he started a thing called Faces. And I've talked to these people. It's not like I've been in the rooms with them where we've had this discussion. But they want anybody who is well known as a public figure to come out and break their anonymity. And the reason for that is they don't have the stigma anymore. Well, first of all, there's no stigma about being an alcoholic anymore. there's five, you know, for every two gay characters, there's three alcoholic characters on every TV show anymore, and half of them are in AA, and it goes on and on. Get bad information because the writers who are writing it are people that didn't really make it in AA, so they're writing it so that you can date somebody seriously when you're 2 weeks sober. So the point being that anonymity has to do with humility. You do not need to see my name, especially my full name, on a thing that says, so-and-so, you know, you gotta come hear him teach the big book. First of all, none of us are teachers. Sandy Beach would tell you that, so would Ollie, Tom I, so would, anybody else that I respected. In fact, the book that, Chuck Chamberlain, we read, you know, New Pair of Glasses, which apparently I stole Johnny Blakely's copy of this, because I pulled it out, I thought it was my copy, and he's gone now, so he won't mind, but I was a sponsor for 20 some years, but apparently I stole his book. But anyway, but that book was not published while Chuck was alive. After he died, two of the guys that, old timers who had recorded him on a weekend that he did with the guys that he sponsored, asked his wife, could we take that and put it in a book? And we'll say Chuck Celia. We won't say Chuck Chamberlain, although everybody knew. Anyway, so, and they did that. But he wouldn't allow that while he was alive. He did not want any notoriety. He was well known because he went around like we used to speak in, and people knew him at these, but he knew that anonymity was extremely important. And anonymity means that there's not going to be somebody's name, up on the, you know, on a flyer that says you're teaching this. I saw somebody recently where it said they were going to teach the 36 principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because there are 12 steps, 12 traditions, and 12 concepts. First of all, of the 12 concepts, 6 of them just have to do with how we do business in New York, and there's nothing spiritual about them at all. 6 of them, like right of minority and right of decision and things like that, do have a spiritual basis. But you kind of have to ferret through that to find that. The traditions, yeah, there's something spiritual about it. But there are not 36 principles. There are just a couple. One is, we don't have any power. Two is, God has all power. And three is, you've got to find some way to connect to God to get that power. God is the Father, and we are the children. And if I am an obedient child who is doing something that pleases my Father will take care of everything I need. I'll talk about that tonight when I talk about being healed of the not just alcoholism, but the cancer that I had and other things. That's the point of my story tonight, is to show that process. But you can be loved by everybody you know. But if you need love so bad that you have to go outside and become a big shot in AA, you're defeating the whole purpose. Anonymity is, you will not gain humility, which is the key to having the power that we don't have when we come in here, if you are putting your name in front of that power. And, you know, we wanted to share some things that you don't always talk about at regular meetings and so forth. And you know, that are useful. So I know many, many people that have these understandings and they use them. And so that was really what the point of this workshop was. Mari was going to do it, but as you know, if you come from Canada and you get COVID down here, you have to stay for 3 weeks at your own expense, before they'll let you back in the country up there. So I'm sure you all see her maybe next year, but it gave us the opportunity to at least share a few things. It would maybe give you something to think about. So we thank you very much.